This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing. And for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book, coming to you from Tan Talk Radio Network Studio here in glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And it is nice to report that we don't have any snow. Oh boy, oh boy. Montana. Hello. I have some friends up in Montana, including CJ Box, who is one of my favorite authors. Oh my goodness, I think you are having 20 inches of snow already. How exciting that is. Okay, well,
Colorado Rockies, too.
In the Rockies, too?
Wow. Snowstorm.
Wow. Okay, well, I don't know if CJ's listening today, but I'm telling you, this is exciting to have it so early. As a Youper, I do love snow. I was born in a blizzard, actually, and the doctor had to spend a night and a day with us because he came in on snowshoes. But I don't think I like snow so early. But we're very lucky here in Florida. We have fantastic weather, and it is just gorgeous. And I am going to be talking at an interview that I taped at the bottom of the hour with Augustine Fuentes. And I will talk more about him later on because I found him absolutely delightful. But right now I'm going to talk to someone who is, she's very famous, certainly in the writing community and among women writers particularly. And Brooke Warner has written a new book called Write On Sisters, Voice, Courage, and Claiming Your Place at the Table. And I'm so happy to welcome you to Joy on Paper, Brooke. Oh, I don't know if she's here yet, but what the heck. Anyway, I'm going to talk about the book. I'm going to talk to her. Eventually, we will get her here.
I am on the line.
You are on the line. Okay.
Yeah, sorry. I guess I was muted. I am here. Thank you.
Okay. We were wondering what was going on with your book. Okay. It is so good to welcome you to Joy on Paper. You certainly have found the joy on paper, and I was thinking about you because I love memoirs. And I often, because I'm a sort of, I write historical books, more or less, and I love history, I really appreciate memoirs. I love memoirs. For a historian, they are so valuable. And I'm writing a book about India in the 1870s, and I love all the memoirs that all these British people wrote about their life at that time because it's so historically significant and so important when you're doing research. So I want to mention that one because that's called Breaking Ground on Your Memoir, Craft, Inspiration, and Motivation for Memoir Writers. And I tell you, when I go to meetings, I often recommend this book because I tell people, write a memoir. It's just a wonderful start to writing. But the new book is called Write On Sisters. I love the cover. I was just holding it up. We're on also YouTube. And it's a delightful cover. Very catchy. And let's talk about you. I mean, you are, as I said, certainly in the publishing world. We all know that you are the publisher of She Writes Press and Spark Press and president of Warner Coaching. You are a great, great writing coach. And what else are you? You're on so many things.
I teach memoir. Yeah, I mean, I have a lot of different things going on in the world of writing.
And I know that you're on the National Association of Memoirs, and this is a great group because, as I said, I love memoirs. So, whoa. This book is so chock full of information. It is absolutely fascinating. And I want to approach it on several different levels. I want to talk about the book itself and perhaps the problems that you discuss in the book, perhaps also solutions. And then I want to talk to you from the point of view of of my work as a radio host. I get so many books. I get so many books, and so I think I have a different an interesting perspective on books that I receive. So let's talk first about what's the premise here of Write On Sisters.
Sure. The premise is basically that there are these various ways, what I refer to in the book as conditioning, historical conditioning, social conditioning, economic and psychological, that stand in the way. You know, they're not things that prevent women from publishing, certainly, but they get in the way of women's process and their confidence, sometimes in the way that they get published, the way that the industry is perhaps set up to funnel women to certain genres, for instance. And so I'm trying to lay out this landscape of conditioning that exists and show how women are negatively affected by it, really for the purpose of so that women can see it for themselves and kind of see what they're up against. And then the second half of the book champions women to move forward despite it and kind of cheerlead them so that they have a sense of strength and camaraderie and community in their writing process.
Now, of course, we all know historically women have had a different position in the world than men. We have different levels of how we've been related to over the years. But so tell us, what did you find just generally about women writers?
Well, I started with history to showcase that women came later to the game, of course. The real ways that women were prevented from pursuing their craft as late as the early 1900s. Women who were publishing in the 1800s were really doing so only because they were in positions of extreme privilege, or they were hiding their writing, or they were publishing under male pseudonyms. And so it wasn't until the 1900s, really, Virginia Woolf published her Room of One's Own just 100 years ago. And so if you think about that, in the sense that women have only really been able to do their craft for about 100 years in the way that we're doing it now, we have a lot of ground to make up. And some of the ways in which the industry functions does actually privilege men. And so I try to lay that all out because I think it's important where women feel biased, where women feel like they're being rejected for reasons that feel to them a little bit strange, or like I said, they might be prevented from publishing into certain genres and kind of sidelined into chick lit or romance or, the kinds of genres that women dominate. These are the kinds of things that I was interested in uncovering, mainly to give us a baseline of where do we sit today in the publishing industry.
Well, when we talk about the different genres, it depends. You know, women write about different things generally than men. The most of the romance authors are women, although there have been some successful men authors. Mm-hmm. But if, there are fewer women writing spy and politics books. It's true.
Right. And I just make the point that, that some of that is by design. You know, perhaps, yes, women would want to be publishing into romance. But the larger question, I don't really tackle romance and these genres, in a very heavy-handed way. The point I'm making and I make in the book is that there's a sort of truism in book publishing, which is that when men write fiction, their audience is everyone. And when women write fiction, their audience is women. And I'm trying to break it up a little bit just so that we take a look at that, because women, are writing a profound and amazing commercial and upmarket books, of course. And it's simply a matter of, like I said, just taking a look at the landscape. It's not to say if you're a romance writer and you love it, great, keep doing that for sure. But what are the systems that are in place that are, maybe disadvantaging women, or the ways in which the marketplace itself is kind of sidelining women's stories? And that's the point that I make. So it's not really to tackle a genre and say there's something wrong with this, but more to show, okay, look at the ways in which we have, you know, kind of these different pipelines and the way that the industry keeps women mainly writing for women and men get to write for everyone.
Well, when you look back historically at, for example, I love books that are going to last. Books that will stay, you know, for 50 years, 100 years. I like books that are going to sort of live on, like Jane Austen, Charlotte Bronte. Now, they were female authors back in the day. They had, of course, difficulty. I think there are as many men who read Jane Austen and Charlotte Bronte today. They still are popular with men as with women.
Yeah, I mean, those are classics, you know, so I think there are a lot of people who have had to read those books in English classes. You know, I mean, you just picked out probably the two only names, you know, that are known women authors of the 19th century. And that says something in and of itself, right? I mean, they were able to stand out, but they had extreme challenges that they overcome. Charlotte Bronte was discouraged from writing. You know, she wrote to the poet laureate at the time to share her work, and he said, why are you bothering this? This is bothering to do this. This is the realm of men. And Jane Austen, you know, similarly had her own struggles that, well, I'm not recalling her specific story off the top of my head right now, but the point is that they did have to overcome. And yes, in terms of men reading those stories, I mean, certainly that's not information that I have at the top tip of my fingers in terms of how many men read those classics. But I'm sure you're right, you know, I mean, in the sense that anything that is classic literature, I think, is pretty well read across the board. But that's not really the point of that I'm trying to make in the book, you know, in the sense that it's more a... it's more just examining the landscape from where we are now to try to help women overcome some of the feelings that they have that prevent them from writing and publishing.
Well, why? Why do they feel that way in this day and age? I mean, why would any woman feel... This is what I don't understand. Why would any woman be discouraged from writing or feel...
Well, I'm making the point that I mean, I work with writers all the time, and most of the women authors I know are either discouraged by the outside world or from inside themselves. You know, there's a lot of doubt. There's imposter syndrome. There's fear of exposure. And then there's real rejection from the publishing industry. So I really think that it flies at them in every way you can possibly imagine, and it is incredibly discouraging. I think if people are writing for themselves or they have a supportive community, they might not feel it, but certainly they will when they start to think about getting published. And anyone who has posted, you know, even personal stuff on Facebook, you know, if you've put yourself out there in an authentic and true way, the likelihood that you've felt some stinging feedback from people is probably pretty high. It's actually very vulnerable to put yourself out into the world, and because that's feedback that I get from women, you know, across the board, this is not a rare kind of occurrence that women feel, I wanted to write a book to say, look, you're not crazy. These are some of the things that exist that might be making you feel that way.
Well, so one of the reasons that you started She Writes Press is to address this problem, to publish women's writing.
That's right.
And explain just to my listeners, because I'm sure many of them will be interested in knowing about She Writes Press. What is a premise? How does this operate differently from other publishing companies?
We are what is called a hybrid press. And so what that means is that the author does invest in their project. They will pay for the production costs and the printing costs. And then we give 60% of the proceeds, 60% of paperback and 80% of the ebook back to the authors. Whereas, you know, the traditional publishing industry gives 7.5% on print and 25% on ebooks back to the author. So the authors invest, but they also get the lion's share of their royalties back. And then the other important part that sets us apart from other kinds of self-publishing entities is that we have a curated process. We vet our projects. We are selective with our submissions. And we also have traditional distribution, so the authors can get out into the mainstream marketplace in a meaningful way.
Which is very important, particularly if you want. One of the best ways, of course, is if you can get your books accepted by a library, which is not so easy. So you do absolutely marvelous work. Now, when people submit to, you know, an agent, do women get rejected more than men? I mean, when you send a query letter, do more?
Yeah. I mean, anecdotally, the answer is yes, right? It's hard to find studies that say, you know, this house rejected X number of men and X number of women, because those are not statistics that actually exist. There is an organization called VITA, however, that is doing counts on bylines for literary journals, and they are doing counts on publishing houses as well to show how many men versus women actually get published. And those numbers are actually pretty astounding. So rejections aside, you can see, and I list some of this information in the book, the discrepancies in journals, literary journals, and publishing houses as well, just that there are still more men than women being published.
Now, but isn't it a fact that most, you know, I was in New York a few months ago to talk to publishers, partly because I want to expand my program to 5 days a week. And I was in different publishing companies. And the majority of the people in a publishing company seem to be women.
Yep, that's correct. And at the top are men. So you will have the vast majority of people working in publishing, I would say probably 85% are women. And the vast majority of CEOs and publishers are men.
But, that's not necessarily a negative when you say the CEOs and even the board members are so often men, because in general, a lot of those are also investors in the companies that they, you know.
I'm not putting a judgment on it, but I am looking, I'm interested in equity. You know?
Yeah,
so
no,
I
understand.
I think that it's a negative, but
if there's,
you know,
if there's
there more women,
if there's 80% of the women, 80% of the publishing people are women. Do you think they reject women more than men?
Again, anecdotally, the answer to that question is yes. Through stories that have been told, I do lay this out in my book, that there is a general sentiment, you know, and the degree to which this is internalized is a whole other question. You know, my book is pretty nuanced, and so I think it's important to look at the way that the stories are told. But the anecdotes show that male authors sell better. You know, and again, this is in certain genres. We're really talking about certain genres, but, you know, men win more awards. And male authors tend to, just be rejected often and get published more often.
So the decision is oftentimes based on, it's a business. So they are basing it on sales.
They are. But I also think that there are subtle things at play underneath everything. Yes, it's based on sales. That's true. But publishing acquisitions are also subjective decisions. You know, so when they're looking at what they think will sell, that's a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? In the sense that they're looking historically at other books that have sold well. In the publishing industry, there's very little desire to take risks. There's also a problem with people of color. You know, you can make this similar kind of analogy that I'm talking about with women, with writers of color, because there are a lot of industry folks who don't want to take those risks. And so of course you can find exceptions to what I'm saying. You know, you can poke holes in this argument. But I'm just saying that it's much easier for an acquisitions committee to say, oh, okay, this guy, you know, this white man is going to sell better because we know he has this defined audience that we understand. And they understand that defined audience also to be women. And so that just is the way that it goes. You know, they'll say this guy has a readership of, you know, men and women that we can wrap our minds around. And they have a harder time making that same justification for female authors because they think that woman will not appeal to men in the same way that a man would. And the same is true for writers of color, that they have a hard time wrapping their minds around who that audience will be because they don't historically know those audiences.
But when given a choice between, you know, in the past decade, I think a few decades, we have sort of, it's been not quite split. I think about in the best-selling authors were, you know, what was it in the last decade? I think it was Clive Cussler or Patterson. Of course, he's always there. You can't get away from that man.
Right.
and he writes everything. I mean, why, you know, give me a break. Now he's writing kids' books, for goodness sakes.
He's writing with Bill Clinton.
Yeah, writing with people, writing with faces. He's always on that thing. But we also have, you know, Danielle Steele, J.D. Robb, Debbie McComber, Nora Roberts, I think Janet Ivanovich. So it's hard sometimes to see, you know, I don't understand if the publishing world and the ones who select the books, really, the ones who select the books are mostly women. And so in the end, I so much of it does come down to money. But one of the important things about your book and why I think so many women should read it, it's called Right on Sisters. And what I like is what you say, voice, courage, and claiming your place at the table. This is important. And you talk very much about how women have to take their place, have to, you know, yeah, of course, you believe very strongly in women getting together as a powerful sort of female groups and just empowering each other. And I'm sort of like, I thought we'd be past this by now. Women are just... I can't say women are superior, but women, listen, women out there, you know, you're pretty smart and you know it. And why hide your talents? You know, get out there and proclaim them and get out there and shout from the rooftops and be strong and don't be worried about criticism. Even the greatest Tolstoy, my God, well, some of the things they said about him, you know. And that's what I love about your book, and that's why I think that people should get this book, and you know, women should get this book, and because you do empower women to be strong.
Yes, certainly efforting to do that, and I think the reality is that we aren't past it, you know, and I try to show that in the book as well. You know, there's a lot of systems that women are up against, and I think we're in a really interesting time right now. You know, I think some of the things that we're seeing on a cultural level, you know, in the aftermath of Me Too, for instance, a lot of women are coming out and feeling emboldened to share their personal stories. There's a lot of things that women, I think, have experienced over the years that have made them feel like they can't or shouldn't come forward. And so it is a really interesting time. And I think women more than ever are feeling that they have really important things to impart and that they want to overcome these barriers to voice, to publication, you know, to whatever the barriers are. And I think it's important to state that, you know, for as much as I talk about systemic barriers, I also really talk about women getting in their own way.
Exactly.
That's a big part of the book. You know, it's not just sitting there going, oh, this all this stuff is against us and there's nothing we can do. No, it's very much about
that you can do it. You can do it.
In your way and stop it. And here's, you know, here's some real ways to think about that so that you can get done what you say you want to get done.
Okay. Well, I want to tell my listeners that they should go to your website. It's BrookWarner.com, and it's Brooke with an E. And she's a coach for writers, and she does so many wonderful things to help women get ahead in this world of publishing. And she has wonderful and very insightful information in this new book called Right On Sisters, Voice, Courage, and Claiming Your Place at the Table. And then when you finish with that book, do get her book up on how to write memoirs, because this is really important. We want to preserve everybody's story. And Brooke, I want to thank you for being on today. I think it's just wonderful, the work that you're doing, and empower more women. And I hope that everyone will get your book.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me on.
Okay. Bye-bye now, Brooke. Okay. Well, she's interesting. The book, I love the cover. Very, very pretty. But I do want to also add one thing, that as much as the fascinating as the book is, and she encourages women to get together, I want to remind everyone that Mary Higgins Clark also has a writing group every Tuesday. She's been doing it for 40, 50 years. I don't know how many years she's getting up there. But it is men and women. And so perhaps that is one of the things that we have to maybe stop dividing ourselves and start just finding strength and power in being together. And perhaps that might help too. But it's something that you want to think about. And Right On Sisters is a fascinating book. I'm going to do a quick book buzz, a commercial. Then I'm going to come back and talk about an author whose book I just love. Okay.
This is Rita Moreau reporting for Joy on Paper with the latest book buzz mystery. Calling Jack Reacher, or my favorite, Joe Pike fans, Tier 1 by authors Brian Andrews and Jeffrey Wilson has close to 4,000 reviews on Amazon. Hey, 90% are 4 and 5 star. Wonder why? Here's the buzz. John Dempsey's life as an elite Tier 1 Navy SEAL named Jack Kemper is over. A devastating terrorist attack takes him from a clear-cut world of decisive orders into the shadowy realm of espionage. His new mission, hunt down those responsible for the greatest tragedy in the history of the U.S. Special Ops and bring them to justice. As Dempsey struggles with the games of spies, the cast propels him across the globe in a desperate effort to prevent a new horrifying attack on American soil. Once John Dempsey followed orders blindly, now the security of the civilized world rests on one question. Can a Tier 1 Navy SEAL adapt and become the world's most lethal spy? Find out in Tier 1 by the author team of Brian Andrews and Jeffrey Wilson. Pretty cool stuff. This is Rita Moreau reporting for Joy on Paper. For more of my suggestions on the mysteries you should not miss, go to our webpage, www.radio-joyonpaper.com, and click on Book Buzz. That's radio-joyonpaper. Hey, while you're there, like us on Facebook. We need those likes. This is Rita Moreau buzzing off for now.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
How many of you listening today yearn to write stories, poems, or novels? Each of you has a story to tell, or knows of a story that others would love to read if only you could put the words on a page. The many writers' clubs in the Bay Area understand this urge and would welcome any new writer to learn with them. So go ahead and take the first step to becoming a well-known author. Sponsored by the Pinellas Writers Club.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and in a minute, I'm going to be playing, actually, an interview that I did with an author. His name is Agustin Fuentes, and I want to ask Big Ed in the control room a question. Big Ed, is it, you know, on television, they're not allowed to drink liquor, you know, on television. Can you drink? Oh, I thought that you're not allowed to, you know, they always had ginger ale in there when on Johnny Carson show, when Dean Martin came on. So I was wondering, you know, in radio, you can drink liquor. You can have a drink.
I
glass.
Suppose you could, because nobody could see it or smell it.
I could have a glass of wine. Okay.
Because you wouldn't be the first.
But it might be the first time for me, because the author that I'm talking to, his name is Agustin Fuentes, and the book is called Why We Believe. Now, it's funny. I just get such a kick out of this guy. The book is very difficult. I'm going to tell you right now. But sometimes in your life, you really need to read a difficult book. Why We Believe. He's so smart. But he writes in a way that once you start reading, you think, oh, yeah, I understand this guy. I really understand this guy. And so I'm going to talk to him, but I've already invited him back on. I'm going to have him back on for an hour. And so I might sit here and sip a glass of wine, because you need a little bit of something when you talk to him. But let's go ahead and talk now to Agustin Fuentes about Why We Believe. Did I pronounce it right, Agustin?
Yes, you did.
Okay. Well, I have to tell my listeners that what should I call you, Agustin, or should I call you Professor? I like Professor.
You know, Agustin is fine. I'm a professor of anthropology, but first name. We're chatting. So
okay. Well, it's. This is a perfect time for me to get this book, because I don't know, I'm going crazy. I think we all are. And Why We Believe is your new book, Evolution and the Human Way of Being. Or I don't know. I am getting, I've been thinking about you all. Well, I got your book a while back. They sent it to me early, so I read it. It's sort of like a guide for the perplexed. What the heck? Oh, I'll just add, before I get into the book, I want to tell people that, you know, Agustin's really smart. He went to Berkeley. Actually, he went to Berkeley when there was still a Department of Zoology.
Absolutely.
Oh, I mean, what was it? Why did they do that? That sounded so good to say Department of Zoology. And they changed it into, what did they call it? No, they call it something.
Integrative biology now.
Oh, yeah. Give me a break. Just because some people can't pronounce zoology, they said, oh, we'll change it. We'll make. Now, you know, we're talking to an anthropologist who can understand everybody's a modus for everything. Why did they do that? I mean, talk about dumbing down.
You know. In a big sense, they were trying to integrate a whole bunch of different disciplines together, so I understand that. But the training I received there in zoology, since I did both degrees in anthropology and zoology, the training in zoology was this classic sort of old science where you have to go out and spend time with the animals you're talking about. You have to sort of watch them in nature and really sort of get down into the daily lives. And that's what stimulated me to study humans that same way. So this, you know, everything doesn't have to be fast and, you know, newfangled.
Yeah, it was more romantic.
Really, well.
It's more romantic. I mean, who wants to have the integrated whatever? I don't care. It was just more romantic. But now you are a professor. Tell us what your current title is.
So yeah, I'm a professor of anthropology at the University of Notre Dame. I'm the chair of the anthropology department here at the University of Notre Dame, and it's really amazing, because anthropology is such a wonderful discipline, because we do integrate everything about the human, right? The biology, the history, the culture, the language, the past. It's a fun place to be, because I have great colleagues, great students, and we spend a lot of time thinking about what makes humans tick.
And I'm talking about what makes human tick. I'm sure that you have one of the most popular classes in the school. Now, partly, you can explain this. I like it. It's almost like you can talk to a psychiatrist. They explain things about your brain, and you can explain things about our nature, because you look like a saint. You know, you belong there at Notre Dame. I mean, you just look so good. And I'm sure that so many people sign up. Of all genders nowadays, we have to say of all genders, sign up for that class just to look at you. So I think it's always nice when a professor, you know, brings a lot to a class.
Well, I love what I do, right? And I hope that's evident in the book, too. Look, this is complicated stuff, but, you know, our brains, our histories, the archaeology, the evolution stuff, our cultural diversity, our faith practices, our practices of love, even our economies, these are really fascinating things. Humans are really fascinating, really complicated. But, you know, it's really important to try to understand this stuff because right now in today's world, you know, I like to be a cautious optimist, but, you know, I'm a little worried about the future.
Oh, you better be. Now, you've lived all over the place. Let's tell people just a few of the countries so they know that when we're talking to you that you know your business. You lived in Micronesia.
I have done research, right, in the United States, in Central America, in Indonesia, in North Africa, in southern Spain, and I've lived in about five times as many places.
So he knows his stuff, people. And I want to tell people, you know, I mentioned The Guide to the Perplexed. This book is almost as, I'm not going to say difficult, because it's not difficult once you get into it. And I want to tell all of my listeners who are writers, get this book, Why We Believe, because they're always looking for motivation in their characters. And a lot of things will be understood in this book. But I want to mention a subject that is, and you can explain it because it's right at the, I've been thinking about it all week. It's been driving me crazy. I knew that you didn't mention it in this book, but I didn't have a chance to go through all your books to see, you know, if you mention it in. Tell me, are there cultures where people are born who are prone to cannibalism and cultures where people are prone not to cannibalism?
No. So that's a fascinating thing, but so I don't talk specifically about that in the book, but this is actually really interesting. Sort of what we are born prone to, what all humans share, is this capacity for belief, this capacity for imagination, this incredible ability to recognize there's more than the here and now in life. And that's ubiquitous across humans. So when you take something like cannibalism, which many of us think like, oh, that's crazy, it actually plays out in multiple different cultures in different ways. So the most common form of cannibalism is in fact what we call ritual cannibalism, right? And we see that take place in many ways. Let me give you an example of the Catholic Church, right? The taking of communion is a kind of ritual cannibalism. I think that's fascinating. That's not the way most people think about it, but you take the body and the blood. So cannibalism is actually a really complicated, deeply interesting pattern. Now, in some places where people eat other people, those are cultural patterns and processes, but no one is born that way. But there are many ways in which we manipulate sort of our belief systems and cultures so that it does emerge.
Okay, because I'm half Finnish, so as a Finlander, I've always had a little bit of an antipathy to Swedes, you know. I'm actually born in northern Michigan. I'm a Youper, but you know, with that with that background, with this. The crazy Swedes coming out and say, let's eat everybody and save the planet. It's just driving me crazy all week. And I've been thinking about what would an anthropologist think about that? Oh, well.
Well, I mean, that it's not surprising, right? We always come up with these, you know, Swift's famous proposal to eat people. You know, what's really funny, though, is because you bring up sort of the Finn and Swedes and all these different cultural conflicts or religious conflicts. I mean, those things are really serious on the planet right now. And what we fail to understand sometimes is that, like, these differences are based in beliefs about the other, right? And beliefs are real for those who hold them. So if we don't understand, if we don't recognize that disagreements are there because people believe different things and understand why they believe those things, then we're never going to sort of be able to meet those problems head on and try to change what people believe.
Well, you know, when, of course, this book, you talk a lot about race. In all of your books, you talk about race and monogamy and all sorts of things. I'm mentioning your other book, too, which is really great. But it seems to me at this point in time, people should realize that race there really aren't that many differences, I mean, or if any, between races. We're all one people.
Right. So, I mean, that's so important. So for example, but here's a good thing that I argue all the time. Data, right, facts about the world, particularly about biology or climate change and things like that, that's never enough to get people to change their minds, right? So I can just lay out, and I have in many articles and books, sort of again and again, here are all the facts that show that there are no biological groups called black, white, Asian, right? Those are actually not biological units, African, European, Asian, whatever you want to call them. There are huge biological diversity across humans, across thousands and thousands of populations. They don't map to races. But race is very real, right? I mean, it matters in the United States when you walk down the street if you're black, white, or Asian because of racism, right? So race is real, it's just not biological. And that's complicated for people to understand because people believe certain things about differences between people, and those beliefs are very harmful.
Well, if nothing else, I hope that people will read this book and get this picture in their heads, that there is no difference between races. Now, difference between cultures and difference between, you know, like I deliberately mentioned the Finn Swede thing because,
yeah,
you know, people
it
would
matters
think,
if you're people, Finnish or Swedish.
Yeah, because Sweden controlled Finland. They were really, the Finns were actually serfs to the Swedes. And my grandfather left Finland because he didn't want to be a serf to a Swede. So I know that, you know, this is an aspect in, and it's nigh in your book, you cover these differences of cultures or differences that, I mean, they're not major, you know, between the Finns and Swedes anymore. We don't really dislike each other that much. But, you know, it's fascinating how you write about all of this and put it into context. And
it's so real, and I think people don't recognize that, that cultural differences are so. So we all accept the phrase, you are what you eat, right? You know, what you put in your body shapes your muscles and biology and all those kinds of things. But what's more important is we are who we meet, right? Who we grow up with shapes the way in which our brain works and the way in which we see the world, the way in which we perceive things. So cultural differences are real, and people see and feel and taste stuff differently depending on where you grow up and who you interact with. So once you recognize those differences, then you can understand why we have these conflicts, but you can also understand that they're changeable. If you think about horrendous conflicts, let's take the country of Rwanda, right? The Hutu and Tutsi, these different groups who ended up, you know, slaughtering, and it's just this horrible conflict. But you know what? They've also reshaped their relationships and reshaped beliefs and done restorative justice and recognized their ways to move forward. And that's incredibly impressive. Look at what happened in South Africa. Look at what Nelson Mandela told us, right? You have to learn how to hate. You're taught how to do that. And the capacity for love is enormous. So all of those things make me hopeful about humans, but we need to recognize. We actually have to do the work to understand that people are different around the world and they really believe those differences and they're real for them. And understanding that helps us understand why these conflicts emerge.
Well, I hope so, because I really don't want Lars there in Sweden to start wanting to eat Finns. So, you know, I want people to start getting, we have to, that's why this book is actually fun. It's funny. You know, when sometimes you get a book, and I mean, you're brilliant and you have all this, you know, knowledge behind you and years of study, and there's, it's scholastic. And by the way, I love that they printed this book. I took the cover off, and they printed this book on a proper book with proper end page.
Real paper.
Oh my God!
I love it. The end page. They did such a nice job. So Yale Press and Templeton Press. What they did with this book. It's beautiful. It smells. I love that smell
I
of
know.
The fresh paper. I'm just sort of a geek, but it is a book.
It is. And when you know, I get it with this cover, and the cover is nice. You know, and for most people, they'll.
Yeah.
But the minute I took it off, I was like. Because I always take, I never read the cover or the blurbs or anything. The only reason I knew that you were gorgeous is that...
You're embarrassing me.
No, really. And I'm sure, you know, all your students, okay, and they sign up partly because of what you look like. But that's the only thing I knew about it. I didn't read any of the promo stuff about the book and stuff. I love to just get into a book and see how it grabs me. And I'm turning the pages and turning the pages. And of course, you talk a lot about, you know, animal life and how animals are, you know, I like the stories about how animals tell us a story about the gorilla looking at an overpass. On the overpass.
Oh, yeah.
I like that story.
Yeah, there's this amazing thing about monkeys and how, like, we inherit a little bit of our awe and wonder of the world from our relatives, the other primates. It's fascinating, yeah.
So, you know...
Do you want me to tell you that story?
Yeah, tell the story. We have time.
So this is something that really blew my mind. I'm doing some work with National Geographic, and we're putting little cameras on these monkeys. And so I'm in Singapore, putting camera on this monkey, and this male macaque monkey. And he's about to cross over. We're watching the camera footage later. We're not watching him do this, but we can see this from the camera. So the camera's under his neck, and it shows us exactly what he's looking at. And so we turn on them, we're watching the footage, and there's this sort of six-lane highway with a sort of a footbridge over it. So we see the male, from his perspective, jump on top of the footbridge and start running across the footbridge because there's a fruiting fruit tree on the other side. And he's running across the footbridge, and he stops. And he turns, and we can see this on the camera, and he turns to this big six-lane highway. And he sort of sits there, and he then moves slightly to frame this beautiful picture of the highway and the high-rises, since this is Singapore. It's like a lot of jungle in the city there. These giant high-rise buildings and a gas station and a restaurant and these cars. And he just sits there checking it out. And we all watch it, and we're mesmerized. It's a beautiful image. So he spends about a few minutes there, and then he gets up and turns away and starts running towards the fig tree. And what that reminds us, and we've had a lot of experiences like this with other primates and other animals, this sort of sense of awe and wonder to look and appreciate beauty, that's probably not just in humans. It is probably much broader than that.
Well, that's why it's because of these little stories that you put in here that make this book very approachable, even for people who think, oh, it's going to be too, you know, difficult. It's not. It's not at all. It's a great read. And the wonderful thing is it's a type of thing where you'll find a chapter and then you want to read it to somebody else and say, did you know this? Did you know? What do you think of this?
Exactly. I mean, thank you so much, because the whole point is, look, I spend the last three decades doing this kind of research and publishing in papers and, you know, articles and stuff that, you know, just in the academy that a few people read. But if what I do, if all of that knowledge, if all that research can't be translated to the public, what good is it? What are we really doing if we can't share the knowledge with the world? So, you know, I do my best to get stuff out there.
Well, I think you've done a great job with this book, and I hope that, you know, I'm... Really, all of you authors out there, if you are writing, you want to understand your characters, you want to understand human beings and what it means, this book is fantastic. And it's an, you know, just a fun read. I've gone back and forth to it. You know, I read it first, and then I went back, and then I'm talking to people about it. I'm arguing with some people about some of the things. Yes, that's what he says. They say, oh, well, I don't know about that, you know. And I like that. Well, I like that I have this kind
great.
Of... Isn't it wonderful? I mean, that's...
That I love that. And I love that it pushes people. And I also tell people, whether you agree or disagree with me, you know, I always put little notes. You can go to the index. You can look at where I get all the information. Go find it out for yourself, you know? If you don't like what I say, see why I say that. We have this incredible brain. Use it.
Exactly. And it comes across in this book. I think it's just wonderful, really wonderful. And it's called Why We Believe... Evolution and the Human Way of Being by Agustin Fuentes. Oh, such a lovely name. He looks like a saint. And then when you finish this book, I want to also, I think Race, Monogamy, and Other Lies They Told You, Busting Myths About Human Nature. That's also a great book.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the plug for the books. And if people want to continue to follow me, I'm at AnthroFuentes on Twitter or afuentes.com. Or if you really want to talk with me, send me an email at afuentes@nd.edu.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic. And what I'd like to do is actually, I'd like to have you back. And maybe we,
sure.
I will organize a time where you'll come back and we'll talk about your other books. And we'll talk, because, as I said, because so many writers listen to this program, they are looking for to understand human nature better. And
absolutely.
I think it would be
well,
wonderful.
I'd love to talk with you about my work on creativity and imagination, because that fits right in line with that kind of stuff. So
okay.
Sure, invite me back. I'll show up.
Absolutely. Again, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. Augustine Fuentes, the handsome guy there at the University of Notre Dame.
I'm going to let you do all my PR from here on.
Everybody, go take a class there. Sign up. Okay. It was great talking to you.
Thanks. Great talking to you as well. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Woo, that was fun. That was fun. And he is going to come back, and I'm going to have it for an entire hour and talk to him. He's just so fascinating. And really, get the book. And if you get the book, do a review on Amazon and mention that you heard about him from Patsy with a Z. I think he'll get a kick out of it. And I want to remind everyone, we did a book buzz for Brian Andrews and Jeffrey Wilson. Thank you, Rita Moreau, for that wonderful book buzz. And they have a fifth book coming out of their Tier 1 series. It's called Red Spectre. And Brian and Jeffrey will be on the program on November 12th to talk about it. And as always, Radio Rita, she did a terrific job of a book buzz for them. And she's going to do another one for the new book because she loves it. This is one of her favorite writing teams. And as a matter of fact, she's the one who brought them to my attention because I had not read their books until Rita said, oh, you have to read these books. They are so good. And I'm really excited that they're going to be back on the program. And again, thank you, Rita. And she's going to be here next week and she's going to start doing a whole bunch of new book buzzes for me. So I really appreciate that. Also, just go to my webpage, radio-joyonpaper.com. And if you have a book that you want me to review, let us know. If you have an author you want me to interview, let me know. If you have a question for Bill Larson of Larson & Larson, our intellectual property attorney who is coming on the program, he comes once a month to answer your questions. So just put it there. It's on the form, and I will be happy to ask him, and then he can give you some good advice because you have to protect your intellectual property. I just heard another sad story of somebody having a real fight because they did something stupid. Do not send anything to Hollywood. Please do not send anything to Hollywood because anybody who tells you they are going to get you a movie deal on the internet, they are lying. Don't send anything to Hollywood. I know. I've been there. And that's not the way it goes. Anyway, just remember one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're really, really lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book or books will be turned into streaming video, a major motion picture, or perhaps on the Hallmark Channel as a wonderful new series because heaven knows they need one. I am so tired of all the repeats. I want a new series on the Hallmark Channel. So listen to me out there. And meanwhile, say something nice to somebody, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. He's always so good to me, and I really appreciate it. I do bother him sometimes, but he's so great. He's always got a good spirit, and I appreciate it. Anyway, have a great day today. It's beautiful here in Florida, and we don't have any snow, and I'm happy about that. Bye-bye now.